Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I am honored this morning to be joined by Rabbi Doron Peres. He's head of World Mizrahi. He is also a family man, a person who was drawn into October the 7th very, very much in the center of it. Rabbi Doron Peres, a very good morning. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Howard. Honored to join with you. And yeah, thank God we're doing okay. Thank you very much.
So for any of our listeners who don't know what happened on October the 7th with your two sons, give us a quick overview just to set the scene and to give some context.
Yeah, so obviously October 7th was an incredibly traumatic time for the state of Israel and the Jewish people, and also for our family. It affected us in two ways. By the time we ended the day, we have four children, two sons, and both are soldiers and officers in the army. The older one, a company commander in the paratroopers, and the younger one, a tank commander in the tank corps. By the end of the day, we had Yonatan lying in Soroka Hospital in Beersheba, having been shot through the thigh, and Daniel missing. And they ended up, the encounter where Daniel was shot, turns out later killed and taken hostage, took place about 100, 120 meters away from where Yonatan, the older son, was shot. Wow. Shot and unfortunately, thankfully, only injured. Right. They both took place in a base called Nachal Oz. Nachal Oz is in northern Gaza on the border next to a yeshuv, a kibbutz founded by the Nachal, I think, in 1949, called Nachal Oz. And Daniel was stationed there on that day, and ended up fighting for 2.25 hours on that day, got into the tank at 6:45. The rockets came over at 6:29, they started. And it's between 6:45 and 9:01, him and his team fought very, very valiantly in the defense of Nachal Oz, the kibbutz, where his position, his tank position, is outside the kibbutz. And after fighting for 2 hours against the first wave of the terrorists, and then the second wave of terrorists came at about 8:45, and that was the critical time for him. He chose, we know this retroactively because they let us listen to the black box of the tank after he was declared dead. He was declared deceased on day 163. But after that, they allowed, when we got up in the morning period and they sat with us, they let us listen to the classified sort of tank communications. And there we heard sort of the whole battle. And there you see at 8:45 in the morning, he had made the tough decision to leave his tank position to encounter the second wave of 50 or 60 terrorists, each one on motorbikes with RPG missile launchers. And he realized that he was the last line of defense. The other tank that had been fighting with him had been neutralized by an RPG and a few of the soldiers killed half an hour before. So he was the only tank. He was the last line of defense. The base had already been overrun. So he knew that he had to engage with them, because if he didn't, he might save himself because he's in a safe tank position. But each person there is a killing machine. And even if he shoots a few shells at them, and even lots of shells, so maybe he'll kill 10 or 20, but the vast majority will get through. So that he went and he engaged with them and killed many and knocked over many. And at the end of the engagement, about 9:01, there were a few terrorists left. One of them, one shot an RPG at the tank, and another one managed to get onto the tank, and he was shot, injured, and probably killed from that. So that's Daniel. And Yonatan, by the grace of God, where he was at our home, and in Yad Binyamin, where we live, when he heard what was going on, by 8:00 in the morning, he left. He took his gun, even though he only had a pistol. He didn't have a handgun. He left his main.
So that's when you were aware, because I wanted to understand your own time frame. Yeah. You became aware of it, obviously, in terms of the sirens. You started to realize, like other people did, that this wasn't just a rocket here or there, that this was something more serious.
Yeah. Look, by us, where we live, it's about 45-minute drive from the Gaza border, 50 minutes. Also, missiles came over to us from 6:30 in the morning.
Right.
So we were in our air raid shelter with our family, including Yonatan and his then fiance Galia. And the truth is, we hadn't received rockets for many years. It was a bit strange. But then they kept raining down for like an hour and a half. Now, it seems strange, but still, it was only rockets. You know, no one in Israel's military establishment ever thought that there would ever be such an invasion. And even when my son at around 8:00 started his phone started pinging nonstop, and he's an officer, and it was from one of his officer groups. And even though it's the Shabbat, the Sabbath for us, he keeps it on because he's an officer. And he said, "Daddy, something's going on. I actually have to look. Something's happening." And he looked on his phone, and he started seeing all the, but he's on a group of 120 officers. And he started looking and started seeing that they were all commenting on noticing a semi-trailer, like a van of terrorists in Sderot. And all of the officers were commenting, like, "What is this? Where is it from? It can't be from Gaza." Nobody thought it was from Gaza. It didn't even cross anybody's mind it could be from Gaza. It can't be from Gaza.
Wow.
They didn't actually
think
it was from Gaza.
That's how unfathomable it was.
And not only that, I heard in the tank, communication, when Daniel, at 6:45, him and the other tank went out the base and had an encounter with about 10 or 15 terrorists. You hear them saying to each other, Daniel and the soldiers, like, "Where are these guys from? They can't be from Gaza. I mean, where are they from?" You know what I mean? Like, it boggled the
so even there, on the border, they actually couldn't.
Even then, they didn't know who they were fighting against. Wow. Yeah, they didn't know who they were fighting against in the beginning. They just didn't know. And eventually they pieced it together. But it just, so we at 8:00 knew something was going on. We thought there was an infiltration. No, the truth is, I didn't think there's infiltration. We knew that there were terrorists in Gaza, in Sderot. Where they're from, who knows? Even Yonatan didn't know. So when he got into the car to go, and his commanding officer told him, his commanding officer said that all of those who can should come to the town of Sderot. Off he went. I must be honest, I wasn't worried because I thought, like, what is this? So there's one semi-trailer. What they need my son, who's a company commander of new recruits, to go. I thought it
with
was
a
overkill.
With a handgun.
I thought it's overkill. I just thought it was strange, but I didn't really worry about it. Now, by then, people are turning on their phones and knew what was going on. We didn't. I started getting a sense that around 12:30, somebody mentioned that they heard that you can keep your phone on Shabbat. And I said, "That's strange. Why would we need to keep our phone on in Yad Binyamin?" So I went to ask the person who people said that he was the one who said that you can do it. He heard from the rabbi. He said, yes, he's heard there's been infiltration into army bases as well, and that the hospitals in the south are full of
That must have been a heart-stopping moment.
That was heart-stopping. But even then, I thought to myself, well, maybe it's only these, what they call them, pillboxes, these sort of where you,
the watchtowers.
Even I couldn't, the watchtowers. I thought to myself, a Nahal Oz base with tanks and what's the name? It's a base. And like I couldn't fathom that. I still couldn't conceptualize it. When things became real for us was at 4:30 in the afternoon, where Shelley and my phone, my wife and my phone just didn't stop ringing. And eventually we, from different numbers, and we saw this was going on for 20 minutes, half an hour. I said, okay, we have to answer it. Something's going on. So we answered it, and it was Yonatan on the other end. And he said, Dad, just listen to me. He said, I've got a few things to say. Firstly, I've been shot and I'm injured. And of course, your son says, don't worry. The first thing is you worry.
Yeah.
He said, Dad, listen to my voice. He said, you can hear I'm okay. I've shot in the leg. I said, where? He said, in the thigh. I said, what about the artery? He said, no, it didn't hit the artery. I've been operated. I mean, they're just doing stitches. Don't worry. I'm okay. I promise you can hear my voice. Secondly, he said, I've been trying the whole morning to get hold of Daniel. I don't know where Daniel is. Since 8:00 when I've been in the car, I've been phoning him. I will tell you, he said, that I ended up fighting in Nahal Oz base where Daniel was based. And I noticed that at 1:00, his tank wasn't there. But often they don't take their phones into the tank, or the tank doesn't have a reception. So I was concerned, but I was grateful that he was in his tank. I thought, you know, it's probably the safest place to be, especially the type of tank he's supposed to be the most advanced in the world. So I felt if he got into his tank, that's already a good sign. Hopefully he's okay and they just don't have reception. And he said, Dad, I cannot explain to you what this place looks like. He said, it's like your worst nightmare you've ever seen. Every 50 meters, there's a car with somebody decapitated and somebody shot, and whether they are young people or old people or grandparents. He said, I can't explain to you this place. You have no idea what's going on over here. Anyway, we agreed that I'd phone him after the Yontif came out, after the Shabbat. And that's when I went to visit him in Soroka Hospital. Anyway, then it developed from there. He eventually came home. And eventually, Daniel became from missing. We didn't know what was going on for days, and we connected with all the other members of the tank, and none of them had heard from their children. There's four in a tank, so once all four haven't heard, now that's serious. Really starting to get worrying. Serious, you know, all four can't get hold of them. And then I heard the next day, Sunday at 4 o'clock, Yonatan eventually got hold of one of the officers who fought in the area. This is having him phone around the whole day, and told him, I heard the phone call where he said, yes, that tank, he saw the tank. There's one dead in the tank and three which are not in the tank. He asked if the one who's dead is the officer, and he said no. So we knew Daniel wasn't dead in the tank. And he said, and what about the other three? He said, we don't know where they are. They're not in the tank. So that's the time we realized that they most.
And by this stage, you knew that people had been taken into Gaza because that information had come through.
Correct. Already at the end of the first day, I think there was knives captive. So we knew that even though he was still missing, that he's probably been taken captive. That's on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It took till Thursday, 7:30, before the army officially came to tell us what's going, because they themselves, there was such a balagan over there.
So this is a common, almost every hostage family that we've spoken to, and I've had the privilege, the horror, the, I don't know, there aren't words this year. We've lost all of our real words, but of any meaning. But this is a theme that it took a long time for any information to come through, and people were doing their own research, as you've just said, phoning this person and Jonathan, phoning this guy and that, just to try and gather information because it wasn't forthcoming.
And this took Israel, as you know, by surprise, like nothing else had. I think on the first day, there were 3,000 missing people because all the phone lines were down and you couldn't get hold of anybody. Remember, of the Nova Festival of 3,000 people, 360 got killed, 50-something were taken captive. Over 10% were either killed or taken captive, probably 12 or 13%. So, and the rest of the people were like running for their lives. So there was such a balagan that day. So I think the army was totally, totally dumbfounded. And society, by the way, you know, I think structured society came to a standstill, but the individuals didn't. Meaning, I think if not for the fact that people like Yonatan and like thousands of other soldiers and civilians would have just come out of their own volition to the front, and other civilians came and saved people and helped people, who knows? Who knows what would have been in that day? So it definitely took a long time. For us, it took five days until they could tell us what was going on, because just you can imagine it was an absolute balagan. 1,250 people dead, 250 people hostages. So they, besides fighting terrorists for 2 or 3 days until Israel was convinced, you know, that they had secured the area, it also took quite a few days of fighting. So it was an absolute balagan before the army was able just to tell us that they know for sure that he's missing. You know, that's crazy, but that's what happened.
And in terms of, you know, I recall following the story from here, and I hear something that you've had. There's some evidence that the family has managed to see that he's, you know, he survived it. Or there was, and obviously holding on to. You know, and I could see community here and friends of yours here, everybody holding on to that little bit of hope. How did you balance not tormenting yourself, not living with magical thinking, not overly immersing yourself in a tunnel in the horror of what he could be enduring? It's almost impossible for me to imagine how you put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah, you know, it's also for me as a rabbi who's you know, who's been with people during their most difficult times. It's difficult, if not impossible, to try put yourself in a position that you haven't experienced, which is something of such profound loss, and in this case, angst, anxiety, and concern. And it's like your worst nightmare. Worst nightmare. Getting.
It's actually worse than your worst nightmare, because it's not even something that you think of. It's not even a nightmare. It's beyond.
It's like beyond. I just think of what Chazal, our sages, say about Yosef, that when Yosef was in Mitzrayim, Joseph, and then Yaakov, you know, could never really get over it because he didn't see the body and he didn't know, and he didn't, you know, like there's this thing. There's this torment that you never know. And here when you know for sure that someone's been taken captive. I mean, like when we had Gilad Shalit's father and parents, how do you function? So it's a very difficult thing to, you know, even begin to imagine. But, you know, for me, it's funny how, you know, each person, not funny, but it's for each person processes it in their own way. For me, I felt from the beginning that if Daniel survived the first day, I believe he would be okay. He's strong. I believe the army, I believe Hamas need him. He's an officer. He's an army. Yes, I believe it would be a long haul, to get him out, but and it's going to be very difficult. But if he's alive, he's with other soldiers, and please God, he'll be okay. And of course, one never knew how long, but it was at least some hope. Once I heard after a month that he had been injured, because it also took a month, even though they had, we knew already on day when they came to tell us already on, you know, on the fifth day, we knew that there was blood in and around the tank. There was blood on a uniform, but it took another month until they did the DNA testing to confirm that it was Daniel's. That was very difficult because once we knew for sure that he had been injured, we didn't know the level of injury, but once we knew for sure he had been injured, then I think, hang on, that's a different story. His head was out the tank. He probably got shot in the upper part of the body. There was blood on the shoulder and the main part of the body. So that started now, really, even though the army couldn't confirm what type of injury, and it was only blood. There was nothing else other than blood. So in their mind, it could have been a light injury. It could have. We all know how much blood you lose just when you go and you donate blood. So we didn't know. But I must say, that was, for me, the first sign where I started thinking, it'll be a miracle if he's alive. And I just want to share with you how it helped me.
Mm-hmm.
The moment I knew that Daniel may not be alive, it actually helped me because I started realizing this is my own, you know, call it magical thinking. I think we don't have a choice but to, the only thing to we've got any semblance
forward.
You have to find a way forward. And I think the only thing we've got any semblance of attempt to control is our thoughts. That's the only thing we've got. For me, I'll tell you how I processed this. And I really try to live by this because I realized if I didn't, it's going to destroy me. I must say, for the first 2 days, I was like in a shock. And I didn't know. I know, like, when, you know, after Aaron was informed of the death of his two children, Vaidom Aaron, I felt like for 2 days, I didn't know where I was. I was like, after the first 2 days, I don't know. It was just one long 48-hour day. I didn't know what. I was in absolute shock. And then it dawned on me on the first day, after 48 hours on the Monday or the Tuesday, I think it was the Tuesday, it dawned on me, you know what? Hashem saved Yonatan. I actually realized that as much as we've got this predicament with the one child, God forbid there could have been two children. I heard on that day that my friend, a colleague of mine, Rabbi Shmuel Slotky, lost two of his sons, Yishai and Noam, and one of them is married to friends of ours from Yad Binyamin. I kept hearing about this girlfriend, the son-in-law of the Miller's family from Yad Binyamin, and I didn't connect it to my friend Rabbi Slotky. It was his son-in-law. The bottom line is, a friend of mine lost two sons, and then I started hearing of multiple families have been taken hostage. So all of a sudden it dawned on me. I said, as painful as this is, and I don't know what's going on, Hashem actually did a miracle. And as I started hearing Yonatan's stories, and his commanding officer came to visit him, he was injured, and fought side by side. And I started hearing not only the incredible heroism, but the miracle of what God forbid could have happened to him. So all of a sudden, this thought came to me, and I said, you know what? I'm actually lucky when it comes to Yonatan. I'm terribly in a predicament regarding Daniel. But all of a sudden, for the first time, I think on day two or three, I was able to actually feel such angst and pain for one and gratitude for the other. Like, I was grateful that I actually felt gratitude because
you might say you experience complexity of emotion, which very often you can't do at a time like this.
I actually felt for the first 48 hours I couldn't even think of anything. I was just in a hole. But all of a sudden I said, you know what? I'm actually lucky regarding Yonatan. And that I think how it opened up for me the ability to say, you know what? Maybe I can think a bit more. Maybe I've got to play with my thoughts a little bit. And then what happened is, as Yonatan, as Daniel, and as you know, our son Yonatan got married 10 days later. And that's an ordeal in and of itself. But I also saw through that.
And were you able? You were able to celebrate that wedding.
I didn't think I would be. In fact, the only way I thought I would be able to, and I've shared this quite a bit, is by, I made a conscious decision not to think of Daniel during the wedding. I said, I'm going to have to put Daniel out of my thoughts.
He stayed outside the venue.
In my mind.
In your mind, but of course.
In my mind, yeah. But actually where I failed with this and where it actually ended up being wrong, because I thought there was no way of bringing him under there without me breaking down and not being able to. But what did I see? When the rabbi at the chuppah started talking about, the rabbi's a friend of mine and he knew Daniel, and he himself is a rabbi in the north of a division, he came down and he was the Maseder Chuppah B'Kiddushim, and he started the wedding in tears saying, how can I start this wedding without acknowledging who's not here? And I looked at him and my mind was going, I said, I hope he's not going to mention Daniel. Please don't mention Daniel. And then he started talking about Daniel. He started crying. So we all broke down. We started davening for Daniel. There was like two or three very, very painful minutes. But then for me, a miraculous thing happened. We had to wash our, clear our faces and continue with the wedding. And we were able to. I said, well, how did that happen? I actually realized that I could bring Daniel there. I was scared of it. And mourn for him at the times where it comes out, a time at the wedding, at the chuppah, at the family pictures. It's okay. And get back to the simcha. I was amazed that we were able to do that. So I think for me, I saw that complex emotions can be handled. But getting back to the thought process, the fact that I knew for sure that Daniel was injured and maybe not alive, I said, you know, that's an advantage, because everyone is worried about their children being tortured. There's a good chance that Daniel's not being tortured. There's a good chance that he's not suffering one iota. Yes, if he's not suffering and he's dead, it means we've got the rest of our lives to mourn. But then I said, but I don't know that for sure. Maybe he's alive. You know? And if he is alive, please God, we'll see him again. So I chose and somehow was able. I'm not saying I was always successful. And there wasn't a day that I didn't cry and I went in enormous pain all of the time. But having said all of that, it certainly for me gave me the ability to think positively. I could have thought the other way, you know, if you want to, and say, you know, either he's being tortured or he's dead, you know, you can think that. Or you can also say either we'll see him again or he's not being tortured. For me, it helped. I must say, it didn't help my wife. Shelley didn't process this at all. It was just 163 days of torment and torture. Torment and absolute torment.
I think for a mother, I think you've mentioned it a few times, for a mother, it might well be different without generalizing, I think it is.
And I will say, though, and which I have shared as well, I will say something which to me was mind-boggling, and I wrote about it in a booklet that I put together before.
I've seen it. Beautiful.
It was mind-boggling for me. It was mind-boggling when I said to Shelley during the Shiva, I plucked up the courage during Shabbos. We didn't have a chance to chat during the week. We were so busy, the Shiva. But on Shabbos, I said to her in the morning, I said, Shel, you know, how are you feeling? And she said, I couldn't believe she said. She said, you know, Doron, I'm actually feeling a sense of relief. I said to her, what? I wasn't feeling that. Relief that Daniel, we're never going to see Daniel again? And then she said something which had such an impact on me. She said, yes, we're not going to see him again. And I've got the rest of my life to mourn. But this is for the first time. It's only my pain. I feel that I can deal with my pain because it's mine. Wouldn't want to take the suffering of the child. And then she said, I now know for sure that Daniel did not suffer, is not suffering, will not suffer. I could not deal with the angst. I just couldn't deal with it, you know. And, you know, I've often shared that she said she could barely eat because he's not eating, and she could barely wash your hands with warm water because, you know, he hated the cold and is he getting on? She said she just couldn't function. Now, I always say that the reason why I didn't worry about that is because I never worried about that, meaning a mother...
Because
as a general,
it wasn't within, you know, your daily worry and concern.
It was never. And my mother, Shelley, every single day would WhatsApp Daniel, are you this, are you that, are you doing, you know, that. I never did.
Have
I,
you
I
eaten?
Never
are you hungry?
That.
Have you drunk enough?
Yeah,
no,
I never.
We unfortunately only have a couple more minutes. I wanted to ask you just a question about faith. You know, we always know the Holocaust stories. There were those that felt abandoned. There were those that rejected the whole notion. Where have I mean, you're a rabbi, and of course you're expected to retain a super level of faith during this time. Did you? Was it natural, or did you need to work on that?
Let me say like this: I feel very, very grateful that I don't have any questions of faith. I just don't. And that's not to say that that's how I would have thought that's how it would be. And I don't feel any anger. I don't know why. It's not like I'm the calmest person in the world. I don't know why. I feel a blessing. But I will say this. Because being a rabbi and witnessing people who've lost, you know, tragic in our community, we had so many tragic circumstances, and holding people's hand through it, so to speak. And obviously, as any thinking person, trying to the Shoah and all of human and Jewish suffering, and then seeing people very close to you suffer, I wouldn't say I had a question of faith during that, but that's the time that I really felt I had to dig deep and answer for myself. You know, how do you is that how do you morally, religiously, spiritually justify or understand anything to do with the Shoah? It's just ununderstandable. And how do you see, what can possibly justify a child, any child, who's innocent going through things? So I think I didn't have a crisis of faith then, but I think I did work through it. I must say now I feel grateful that I didn't have the questions now. And I feel a certain part of me actually feels that if I now had the questions, there's a certain arrogance about that. Because when 1.5 million babies were killed and people lost families in the Shoah, then I didn't have a question. And all of a sudden now it's a little bit sore for me. And all of a sudden, meaning, who am I? Does God owe me something what he didn't owe the Klausenberger?
amazing way of looking at it. I could do this for another half an hour, but we can't. They're going to throw me out of studio. I wanted to get to where to from here about the work that you're doing with the UN. Maybe we'll see if we can set up something else. But Rabbi Doron Peres, people are messaging me. I'm a better person for hearing this interview. Well done to you for being able to share this. And please know that our thoughts, our prayers, our love with you and Shelley and with the family.